I'd like to welcome you all tonight. We have a special treat with Michael Q.B. McDowell. I'm really great at tripping over names. He's written books such as The Quiet Pools, and Trigger is the latest one they wrote with Sir Arthur Clarke. And rather than spend a lot of time up here standing, I'm just going to turn the podium over to him. Welcome.
Thank you. This is the first time I've had a public appearance since I've had to need these for reading. And if it looks like I don't quite see you, it's because I don't. I can either see you or my notes, and I don't know, it's going to be interesting. Well, this is a real pleasure for me because of something that she didn't mention, which is that I'm an MSU grad. I graduated from here in 1976. So actually I haven't gotten very far away from here yet because I now live over in Okemos. But I have the usual assortment of MSU nostalgia going for me here. I mean, I lived for 2 years in Armstrong Hall in Brody, and the other 2 years in an apartment on Delta Street, just north of campus, you know, where the little V is, where Michigan and Grand River come together. In fact, I wrote my first novel partly in the dorm and partly in that apartment. Now, that by say first novel, I don't mean first published novel. I mean that one that goes in the bottom drawer. But the trunk job, as some of us call it. But I have all the usual MSU nostalgia, throwing paper airplanes off the parking ramp at midnight, waiting across the Red Cedar behind the administration building. I will not confess to having added anything to the paint underneath the bridge, but I certainly know where it is. I've gone parking in the farms with a young lady. Steam tunnels. I can't say anything about the steam tunnels. I'm under court order. I left here with a degree in elementary education, science, math major, or concentration. I forget exactly what they called it in those days. And so if you don't mind, and if you do, why are you here? I want to start by reading a little something that I wrote last year that's nonfiction, because it hasn't seen very many eyeballs yet, despite the fact that, to my great surprise, it won an award. A friend of mine who happens to work for a publication called School Planning and Management coaxed me to write an essay about education in the future for the millennial issue of that magazine. And then she turned around and submitted it to the Association of Educational Publishers competition. And it won in the editorial or essay category. So I figure the subscriber base for School Planning and Management is probably about 32. So we will increase the number of people who have heard these words by about half tonight, I think. In the hit film The Matrix, members of a cyber underground can learn everything there is to know, from jujitsu to piloting a helicopter, by having it uploaded to their computerized consciousness. Mastery is attained in less time than it takes to read this sentence. It's an appealing fantasy, offering the promise of instant and painless expertise, and neatly sidestepping the nagging problem of motivation. The magic helmet represents man and machine merging in a way that makes the most of the strengths of both. But this enduring science fiction motif also highlights the limitations of the human data interface on which education now depends. Our five senses, principally sight, hearing, and touch, and the old-fashioned brains which are monitoring those inputs. Compared with the speed at which information flows in the digital world, these old analog protocols, reading, listening, watching, doing, seem woefully inefficient. None of the new technologies starting to reach the classroom are likely to make ninth grade English students faster readers, or speed the passage of a college biology class through the contents of a 700-page textbook, even if that material is now stored on a web server or viewed on a satellite cellular palm. The greatest promise turn-of-the-millennium communications technology offers educators is in bringing the universe and all we know about it to a student's digital desktop, in vivid color and 3D sound. But for learning to take place, that information still has to pass through the human eyes and ears to an engaged human brain. That bottleneck that must be addressed, that is the bottleneck that must be addressed if we are to add much needed breadth and depth to a general primary education without extending it well into adulthood. What if instead of plugging in a smart desk, a personal comm set, or a virtual reality headset, we could plug in the students themselves? The nature of the mind remains perhaps the most intractable puzzle the human mind has confronted. Though the decade of the brain, now concluding, vastly expanded our understanding, the neurobiochemical processes which produce memory, cognition, recognition, and consciousness are still only dimly glimpsed. Writing in a recent issue of Scientific American, neuroscientist Antonio Damasio described the state of his art as, quote, quite incomplete, no matter how you slice it, end quote. Nevertheless, Damasio is optimistic that by the middle of the next century, this century, advances in neuroscience will erase the dualism of mind-brain and give us the makings of a technology of thinking. Quote, a substantial explanation for the mind's emergence from the brain will be produced, and perhaps soon, Damasio writes. There is no reason to expect that neurobiology cannot bridge the gulf. Now, whether that emerging technology will allow for the magic helmet of science fiction will depend on what we learn about evolution's most mysterious invention. It may be that there is no way to force-feed a human brain, which hasn't already been discovered in a million years of parents teaching children. The senses may remain the only points of access to the mind. But even if jacking in remains a fantasy, exhaustive knowledge of the brain as a biomachine is almost certain to produce a powerful toolkit for optimizing its performance. Parenthetically, I really want a copy of Norton Utilities for the brain. I want to do a defrag. I'm sure I have some cross-linked files. Whatever form it takes, this will almost certainly prove a mixed blessing. For stripped of its cultural cloak, education is an attempt to manage the stimuli reaching the senses. And the dark lining is that the same technologies which present the mind with wonders can also be used to program it with lies. Moreover, while some might see a prospect for the final democratization of education, with every student sculpting a unique curriculum, we must remind ourselves that mere access is not enough. Is a digital library of 10 million volumes any more valuable than a single paper book to someone who chooses not to read, or even to learn to read? Our 20th century experience with the primitive virtual realities we call video games raises a real prospect of entertaining ourselves into oblivion, the human equivalent of the rodent repeatedly pressing the button which sends an electrical charge into the pleasure center of its brain. If access is all that mattered, the History Channel would be as popular as Pokemon. It may be that the most valuable secret waiting to be unveiled by neuroscience is the secret of human curiosity, most especially how to repair it when it's been abused. If we don't have the magic helmet by 2099, we will surely wish we did. For the safest prediction of all is that the explosion of human knowledge, invention, and creation in the 21st century will dwarf that which we witnessed in the 20th. Lifelong education will be necessary but not sufficient in a future where the sum of all knowledge far exceeds the capacity of even our most gifted Renaissance men and women to absorb. The real experts of the year 2099 will be those who are most skilled at framing questions and finding answers in a cross-cultural planetary library, an Encyclopedia Humana that doubles in size every year. They will have at their fingertips the accumulated experience of billions of their brothers and sisters, and they will leverage that knowledge to accomplish the stuff of dreams. Even so, I expect my great-great-grandchildren to discover two hoary old 20th century truths are still holding fast: that there can be no learning without thinking, and no wisdom without time for reflection. And the great teachers, whether they're self-aware computer programs or self-aware flesh and blood, will be those who can help their students find reasons to pursue both. And that's where that ends. Now, there's an idea in there which has become kind of part of the furniture of science fiction, and that's the idea of that planetary library. Now, I like this idea. Sitting in the middle of my office, surrounded by bookcases that cover all the walls, some of which are blocked off by the boxes that contain the books that don't fit on the bookcases that line the walls, and knowing that I put something away somewhere, but where. I've often wanted to be able to, as a Unix person might put it, grep the paper in my office and find that missing document just by asking for it. I have to be the index to everything I hold on to. And I'm not as good at it now as I was when I was 35. And I'm scared of what it's going to be like when I'm 55. So I don't have a very big window of opportunity here for this to develop. The idea of being able to sit down and access the sum total of human knowledge is a wonderful notion. I've used this in some of my books, probably use it again, because I think there's a certain inevitability about it. But the question is, how do we get there? I will confess, and here I risk alienating my entire audience, I was a bit disappointed when I saw this headline a couple of months ago. It said the university had chosen not to block Napster. So there it is, I'm on the other side, that's right. And the reason for that is kind of complicated, and I'd like to try to talk about it a little while before I move on to some more readings. I'd like to see if I can talk about Napster and Nutella and Freenet without calling anyone a thief or a pirate. It'll be a good challenge. The problem in getting from where we are to this ideal of the planetary library is part pure mechanical. There are vast numbers of books, magazines, newspapers, and so forth that only exist as paper, and getting them digitized is a non-trivial problem. It's partly a problem of permissions. And there's where we start to get things, there's where we start to divide. I mean, there are so many conflicting views on this. I've been hanging out for a few months in alt.binaries.ebooks, which is a place where, I can't use the word pirated. It's a place where borrowed copies, digital copies of books are traded. I have installed Nutella on one of my computers, purely really to see what's out there, just kind of keeping up with things. And most people are aware, I think, of what Napster is and what it represented as far as the music industry is concerned. You know, the publishing industry seems to be on the same path, just a little further back down the road, because our product is paper. It's not digitized yet. The e-books are not out there to be readily and conveniently traded and emailed and posted onto the net. But obviously that's coming. And some people can't wait for it and are pushing really hard for it to happen faster. This is one of those cases where I think it's really easy to see the benefit and hard to see the harm. It's obvious to me that it would be wonderful if, well, hold your palm up there, Matt. If I could carry one of those around and it had, 1,000 books in it, this would be tremendously useful. If it had 1,000 books and a wireless link to the rest of them, that would be even more useful. But somewhere along the way, we're going to have to figure out a way to compensate the creators of those works, or we'll do what our forefathers called eating the seed corn. Because you have to compensate people for their effort. I mean, the free riders are the problem. And if they're all free riders, then there is no economic system that allows the creation of the works that you desire in the first place. One of the ironies about this, actually, is that the most popular thing on alt.binaries.ebooks, except for possibly computer manuals, are science fiction books. So it's sort of like being loved to death by by the fans. None of my books have been pirated yet. None of my books have appeared on alt.binaries.ebooks yet, but it'll happen eventually. A number of authors of Sir Arthur's books have, Greg Bear, Misty Lack, I mean, a very long list of people. Harlan Ellison has taken them on and won one court fight against one particular poster. But I think having it fall down to a struggle between the people who say, you can't stop me, and the people who say, it's wrong to do this, I think to some degree misses the point. We're still all people who love books, the readers and the writers both. And I don't know that there's a writer anywhere that wants to limit access to their work. I don't think there's a writer anywhere who is hostile to ebooks, okay, as a concept. But it is true that most writers, certainly most of the writers that I know and that I've been hanging out with for the last 25 years, are kind of economically marginal. Okay, it's not a lucrative profession, except for a very few that whose wealth perhaps deceives people about how well writers do. You know, there's one Stephen King. There are 1,500 members of SIFWA, the Science Fiction Writers of America. There's one Michael Crichton. Even some very well-known names do not do very well financially. So for people who are at the edge or feel like they're right at the edge, the idea that that people love your work so much that they're going to take it and give you nothing back for it except maybe some appreciation, you know, is hard to deal with. Stephen King can afford to have his work pirated. In a literal sense, he can afford it. I don't know if he's happy about it, but he can afford it. How do you pay the creators so they have reason to keep creating? And that's going to be a real tough problem to work out as we move further and further down this road. It's a classic problem of the free rider, the economic problem of someone who is receiving a benefit and not giving back anything. When you buy a CD, you're supporting the system that created the CD. When you download an MP3, you're not. It's as simple as that. And if there are enough people that are still buying it, then the system doesn't collapse. But at some point, when your customers start becoming free riders, then that's the end of the road. How are we going to get there? Patronage? Should all writers be seeking out wealthy patrons to finance the writing of their works? I saw an offer posted on alt.binaries.ebooks from someone who said, I will put up $20,000 for someone to write an anti-abortion science fiction novel and release it as an ebook. Okay. When you have patronage, you often get the heavy hand of the patron in the middle of the creative process. Government arts grants, shall we talk about the NEA? Different hand, but same problem. I don't have a solution to offer. I do have a fanciful notion that we ought to take the copyright system and change the fee system, so that instead of paying them to register the copyright, when you send something to be copyrighted, they pay you, and that's a fee for putting it into an electronic Library of Congress. But we still have the problem, potentially, that every book written will sell one copy, which someone will then saw the binding off of, run through a scanner, and publish to the world. So in the patronage system, I guess the patron gets the one copy for his $20,000. Why aren't there more ebooks now? Why are they so expensive? These are complaints that a lot of people have. I mean, if you've got the device already, you want it now. If you've got an ebook reader, if you've got a Rocket or a Softbook, you want them now. And if you go to the catalogs and you look what's out there, the selection is somewhat limited and the prices seem awfully high to people who said, you know, this thing has no intrinsic cost. I'm just making a copy of these electrons. Why shouldn't it be darn near free? I'd pay $2. I'd pay a dollar. I wouldn't pay $8.99. You know, why should I pay a dead tree price for an electronic file that when I've taken it, you've still got it? I haven't taken anything away from you. And that's it's hard to argue with that in some senses, except if you, again, go back to the eating the seed corn problem. To some degree, I have to say that I look upon Napster as what happens in a riot when they go into the stores, break the windows, and take everything. You really can't expect the store owner to come back the next morning and restock them so you can do it again. It's a difficult issue. We don't write just for money, but we write more when we can concentrate on it. There are some writers who don't need money. Larry Niven has had a trust fund, his whole family trust fund his whole life. He's had the freedom to just write whatever he wants to write, when he wants to write, and that's wonderful. But there aren't that many people in that situation either. And I don't know if we want a culture, even if it's an entertainment culture, that's dominated by the wealthy. Because I think there are probably issues that the middle class and the underclass also have and want to explore and talk about that might be worth exploring and talking about. So I don't have an answer, but this seemed like a wonderful place to raise the question. And I'm going to move on and talk about a book that I hope will end up in the Planetary Library 100 years from now, even if I don't know how it'll get there. And that's the book that Arthur C. Clarke and I wrote called The Trigger. Now, this also has an MSU connection. On April 11th, 1973, Arthur C. Clarke spoke as part of the university lecture series at the MSU auditorium. And I was in the audience for that. I think we had the place about half full, which was pretty respectable. And after the address, I came forward with my paperback copy of Childhood's End, and I got it autographed by him. You know, pure fanboy. I mean, this is somebody I had been reading since I was since I graduated out of the children's room at the library. Okay, Clark, Heinlein, Asimov were the three principal contributors to my science fiction reading as a young man. And so I was just thrilled to have a chance to listen to him, to talk with him for a little while. He stayed down in front of the stage and talked to three or four of us for 20 minutes or so. Wonderful gentleman, a very classy individual. And if you had told that sophomore that 25 years later, there'd be this, first of all, if you told me that I was going to successfully publish anything, but then if you went on and say that I had was going to be a co-author with Arthur C. Clarke, I would have thought you a fool. And frankly, there have been moments all through the creation of this book when that fanboy that was standing at the front of the auditorium emerged again in my heart. You know, it was just... Arthur is, he's a terrific gentleman. As I said, he treated me as a peer throughout, never a hint of anything but, and yet it was still, thank you, was in my heart. How did it come to be written? I want to say a little bit about that. Arthur is in his 80s now. He has an advanced case of post-polio syndrome. You know, there are a lot of different kinds of collaborations in the science fiction world. And there are some that are frankly just a chance to merchandise a name or a series. Actually, I know that because I wrote one of those early on. A book called Isaac Asimov's Robot City was arguably the first of sharecrop novels, as some people call them. And that was not a collaboration. That was my book with Isaac's name very big on the front. And as far as I know, he didn't even make a significant contribution to the outline. My understanding of how that developed was that he and the book packager, whose creation this really was, had a series of expensive lunches in New York and talked about various things relating to the robot universe. And then the book packager went back to the office and wrote the outline and then started lining up authors for it. And I wrote that as a pay-the-rent project after I'd finished the Trigon Disunity. We were waiting to see what sales were going to be like on that, whether somebody was going to offer me a contract for another one of my own. And it was just kind of an in-betweener. I never had any contact with Isaac at all. No telephone calls, no letters, and nothing. I know he read it, but that was way at the end of the process. Now, there are also collaborations which represent an effort by a name author to pay back by paying forward. They bring young writers into a limelight, into the spotlight by use of their name. Marion Zimmer Bradley is probably the best example of this. She brought a very large number of writers, mostly women writers, but not exclusively, onto the stage through her Darkover anthologies and her, I've forgotten the name of the other, the Sword and Sorceress anthologies, and really was a mentor to a lot of writers. And then there are your ordinary collaborations, which are between two people bringing their particular set of skills to a project. And this was one of those. Now, how did we get there, being, Sir Arthur, legendary, and I'm not embarrassed by my record, but I'm 40 years younger. I'm an entirely different generation. No personal contacts, actually, other than that one in the MSU auditorium. How do we get there? Well, Arthur has an advanced case of post-polio syndrome. That's one of the issues here. If he could have written this book entirely by himself, I believe he would have. But he's physically not up to it. So that's what opened the door for me to have the opportunity. Arthur had two ideas that he wanted to see written before he quit writing fiction, and he has now announced that he is no longer going to write any more fiction. He had two ideas he called his wish fulfillment stories. One of them turned into this book, and one of them turned into a collaboration with Stephen Baxter called The Light of Other Days, which was published earlier this year. So I am completely unembarrassed to say that I did the heavy lifting. Okay, but that this was a collaboration between equals in this sense. You cannot go through this book and say what's his and what's mine. I can't even do it. We kept in touch by email primarily because the difference in, he doesn't leave Sri Lanka very often. In fact, the only time I know that he's left in the last 3 years, 4 years, well, he's left twice. He went to England for an anniversary of the 2001 special event there, and he came here for some treatment at Johns Hopkins for his post-polio syndrome, and that was pretty much the limit of it. Now, there are three kinds of science fiction novels. Well, there are two kinds of people. People that say that there are three kinds of science fiction novels and the people. There's the what-if story. There's a classic categorization. The what-if story, what if there was a such and such? What if such and such happened? And spin out the consequences of that wrinkle in the fabric of the reality that we know. What if Hitler had gotten the atomic bomb first and run from there? There's the if-only story. If only we could do such and such. It's, you might call it the optimist's science fiction novel, where there is an element of wishful thinking in the construction of it. And there's the if this goes on novel, which is just the other side of the same coin. It's the warning. Get the wishful and the warning and the speculative. And I've been really interested to watch the reactions to this book because there are people who will swear up and down that it's each one of those three. And I think that says that we did a pretty good job at what we were trying to do, which was open a dialogue. The people who think if only, who see it as an if only novel, agree with the, with what some of the people in it are trying to do. The people who see it as an if this goes on novel hate the idea of what the people in it are trying to do. And then there are people who are just listening to the argument and looking at the what if we had a device that could neutralize most of our modern weapons? How would that change things? How would it affect international politics? How would it affect the politics of your own, of your street, of your, you know, all the entire range of opportunities? It's 200,000 words long, which makes it the longest thing that I've ever been involved with. I wish it was another 100,000 words long, frankly, because there was so much that we could have been doing with it that there simply wasn't an opportunity to do. And yet, I'm extremely proud of it, extremely pleased to have had a chance to be involved in the writing of it. And I'm going to read you some bits and pieces from it. Now, the bits and pieces that I've chosen will probably make it sound more like an if only, because they're from the first half of the book, before everything goes to hell. The point that I would like to make, though, is that there do exist among us in the world meliorists, people who think that we can do better. And the principal players in the trigger, the people who drive the story forward, are meliorists. They believe that we can do better, and they try to push us in that direction. The book is really about the consequences of their efforts and how that plays out. I'm going to take a sip here before I pick the book up. There is a story here, and yet most of what I'm going to read you are conversations, because I think they're the most interesting part in some ways. But I just want to know that in between, you know, when I skip, there is story in there. There are narratives, conflicts, other than just people talking. And yet, if you are an Arthur C. Clarke fan, you'll know that actually the conversation is an essential part of the kind of story he tells. Because they're stories about ideas as much as they're about people. So, please watch for the gratuitous Michigan State reference in this first selection, which is the prologue. And in the prologue, we'll meet two of the principal players in the story. Prologue, The Chosen. With resignation, Jeffrey Horton surveyed the clutter in the hardware-filled second bedroom he and his roommate self-mockingly called the Black Hole. Data disks and tapes were scattered under and across the several tables, and a mortally wounded CD-ROM was pinned under the caster of one of the chairs. Assorted first-generation computer components and test gear formed precarious mounds of metal and plastic in the corners. There was a jumble of cables on the seat of Horton's chair, and a sagging, badly overloaded shelf of books and manuals loomed over the large monitor like a sword of Damocles. The normal level of chaos in the Black Hole was one that only another gearhead could love. Most of Horton's friends had at least one room like it. But it was obvious from the overflowing cardboard boxes in the middle of the floor that Hal had been hitting the Silicon Valley electronic swap meets in the weeks Horton had been away. If it's broken, I can fix it. If it works, I can use it, was Hal's self-proclaimed motto. It was hard for him to say no to any flea market bargain, even a complete Windows-era computer for $25. Somehow, the Black Hole absorbed them all. Resisting the temptation to paw through the boxes to appraise Hal's latest finds, Horton retreated from the room and firmly closed the door after him. The mound of dirty clothes on his bed and the accumulation of recyclables on the apartment balcony deserved higher priority than beating back entropy in what their landlord grumpily called the unlicensed salvage yard. It was then that Horton heard someone knocking on the apartment door. The knocking was sharp and impatient, as though it had been going on for a while, which it might have been, since it was competing with the white noise of the elderly dishwasher whooshing and rumbling away in the tiny kitchen. Hastening to respond, Horton only glanced at the corridor monitor long enough to see that the caller was a silver-haired man in a long cloth coat. Releasing both locks, he opened the door to the floor stop. "Hello, I'm looking for..." the caller began. Then he straightened his shoulders and smiled broadly. "Well, and here you are." Horton was staring dumbly at a face that had no business appearing at his door. "You're Carl Brohier," he said, blinking and shaking his head. He had no precedent for how to act when a Nobel laureate appeared at his door like a campus missionary. And he fell back on repeating himself, "You're Carl Brohier." "I know," said the older man, his head cocked at a slight angle. "And you're Jeffrey Allen Horton." He gestured with the bottle of wine he was carrying. "May I come in?"
Of course, Dr. Brohier," Horton said, retreating a step and allowing the door to open fully.
"Carl," the visitor corrected. Horton could not allow himself such presumptuous familiarity, and so simply nodded acknowledgement. "I have to apologize for the mess. I just got back from being away for most of 3 months." "Yes, I know," said Brohier as he brushed past. "How did you like it in the Midwest?" "I wasn't ready for snow in the spring." Brohier grunted in amusement as he searched for a place to sit down. "And Marsh Tolliver, how did you find him?" Tolliver was the director of the National Superconducting Cyclotron Laboratory at Michigan State University, where Horton had gone to trade his service as a volunteer intern for cyclotron time in support of his doctoral thesis. "He has high expectations," Horton said. "You are too polite," said Brohier, settling on the one kitchen chair not piled high with mail. "The student disease, you'll get over it." Tolliver is a tin god bureaucrat masquerading as a scientist, unfortunately all too common for the top post at government sites. All of the good work that comes out of NCSL nowadays is due to Ginger Frantala, the assistant director. I'm sure that she's the one Professor Hang spoke to arrange your visit. Did you get what you needed out of your time there?" There seemed to be nothing about him that Brohier did not already know. "The results supported my thesis." "Excellent. I look forward to seeing them. Are you going to publish?" "In a referee journal? I'm not sure it merits..." "Oh, I think it does. From what the old tiger told me..." The old tiger, he loves that nickname. "It'd do you no harm to arrange for him to overhear you using it." Brohier chuckled to himself. "Send your paper to Physical Letters B. I'm on the referee list there. I'd give it a fair reading." "Dr. Brohier..."
"Carl," the visitor insisted.
Horton flashed a quick grimace, then nodded. "Carl," he said. "Carl, you are looking at one very confused person. I mean, it's a great honor to meet you. I've read your papers. I was delighted when you won your Nobel Prize. I consider it a privilege to be having this conversation." Brohier waved away the praise. "I'm already 67 years old, Jeffrey. Get to your point." Gesturing with both hands, Horton asked, "Why are you here? Forgive me, but it's sort of like having Miss April show up at a frat house." An easy, surprised laugh softened Brohier's dramatic features. "And ask the president out on a date," he said. "Yeah, about that improbable." "Life is improbable, but real. I came here to ask you what you're doing for the next 10 years. If you have nothing better to do, I wonder if you might consider coming to work with me."
"Excuse me?"
"The Nobel Prize does open doors, not only yours. Not quite a year ago, a very forward-thinking man named Aaron Goldstein approached me about establishing a new research center. I told him there was only one way I'd be interested. If he'd let me collect as many of the top young minds as I could and give them the tools and the freedom to pursue whatever they thought promising."
"Sounds like grad school without grades."
Brohier smiled. "I told him I didn't want to run a bottom-line driven gadget factory, that I thought what we needed was an idea factory, working at the boundaries, pushing back the boundaries."
"New science creates new opportunities?"
"Yes, it does," said Brohier. "It always has." "I told him I wouldn't sign off on a business plan, couldn't tell him what we would come up with or how much it would be worth, couldn't promise him anything concrete. Then he asked me how much money I've made from my patents and licenses on solid-state memory, and I told him." He said that was good enough for him, and we shook hands. "In about 5 months, Jeffrey, I will put on my administrator's hat and open the doors of a state-of-the-art research campus being built outside Columbus, Ohio. I'd like to have you there from day one. Are you interested?"
"Just tell me who I have to kill," Horton said.
Brohier grinned broadly. "This bottle contains a cork," he said. "Does this apartment contain a corkscrew?"
"It did when I left."
"Then endeavor to locate it, and you and I will kill this fine Bordeaux and a few of our gray cells together. Welcome to Terabyte Labs, Jeffrey. Start thinking about what you want to work on next." Okay.
Well, we jump forward a number of years, and actually Jeffrey has not had a particularly productive time at Terabyte. His major project has been a nightmare that will not end, and then there comes a day, and I will not be reading that part of it, but in the attempt to find A, he finds B, and B is something that he does not understand, that Carl Brohier does not understand, that no one who knows about it understands, but that affects nitrate-based explosives and propellants by making them go off. And this action operates at a distance. If we had a box of shells in the back corner and we turned on the unit here, we would not have a box of shells in the back corner a moment later. And this extraordinary discovery, it's like being gifted with the world's largest problem. What do you do with it once you've caught the tiger? We're going to jump ahead to a conversation, a meeting involving Carl Brohier and Jeffrey Horton and the financier behind the project at Carl Brohier's house. There was a black coupe at the end of Carl Brohier's driveway and two men in black suits standing behind it. They eyed Horton carefully but made no move as he drove past them, except to turn and watch him. Not lab security, Horton thought, stealing a glance in his rearview mirror. Private security, bodyguards, for Carl or his guest. A silver Mercedes sedan was parked on the cobblestone half circle by the house, and a slender woman in a smart chauffeur's uniform was coming down the walk from the front door. She stopped at the driver's door of the Mercedes as Horton pulled up behind it, then slid behind the wheel and pulled away as he climbed out. He peered into the sedan as it made the big turn and headed down the drive, but saw only the driver. The presence of guards in the driveway tempered the surprise when the front door was opened by someone other than Brohier, in point of fact, by another broad-shouldered man in a tailored suit. Again, there was the steady gaze, the snap appraisal, the calm alertness. "Come in," the man said, ushering Horton inside. "You'll find them on the sky porch." Taller than it was wide or deep, the north-facing two-story space Brohier called the sky porch looked out on the upslope forest and the sky through great sloping panels of glass. A pair of avocado trees and a giant Diffenbachia brought the forest inside and separated a sunken tile hot tub from a casual seating area. There Horton found Brohier and his guest, a slender man with a short-cropped, full white beard and a wealth of smile lines around dark, deep-set eyes. He was casually dressed in golf shorts, polo shirt, and well-worn sandals and had his feet propped up on the rounded edge of a low stone table. "I have never micromanaged your budget, Carl, and I won't start now," the guest was saying as Horton approached. "Ah, here he is." Brohier twisted in his chair to look back over his shoulder, then stood. "Jeffrey, I want you to meet Aaron Goldstein." Horton had already guessed the identity of the visitor. He had never met Terabyte's principal investor and majority owner, but there was a photo of Goldstein and Brohier in the director's office, and Horton had searched the hyperweb for information on Goldstein shortly after arriving in Columbus. The most useful information had come from the Fortune site, which mapped Goldstein's extensive holdings, 31 companies in 11 industry groups, with the cash cow among them being Advanced Storage Devices, the exclusive licensee of Brohier's solid-state memory patents. The most interesting information had come from the gossipy microscope pages, which had named him America's most ineligible bachelor, snidely commenting, "Never before in our memory has anyone with so much managed to enjoy it so little." Goldstein shook to shake hands, then settled back in his chair. "Do you like Chinese food, Jeffrey?" he asked. "Some," he answered, nonplussed. "Good, sit down, please." Goldstein waited only for Horton to start moving before he went on. "I want to congratulate you on your discovery. It's stunning. I've scarcely been able to think or talk about anything else since Carl told me, which has been quite a burden on him because I haven't anyone else I can talk to. Of course, now I have you too. And the first thing I want to say is well done. This is revolutionary. In the same way the Watt engine, the Marconi wireless telegraph, and the Hollerith tabulator were revolutionary." He chuckled. I like those examples because every one of those men managed to make money while they were changing the world. I confess I haven't been able to see any way of making money from this, Horton said. That's all right. I have. Change always creates opportunities. I've acquired 3 companies and 200 patents in the last 10 days. Then the twinkle of self-satisfied glee left his eyes as he sat forward in the chair. But that's completely irrelevant. Do you know why I created Terabyte, Jeffrey? From what Dr. Bro here told me when he hired me, I assumed it was more or less for the same reason farmers plant seeds and investors buy futures. You're only partly correct, said Goldstein. What I wanted was to create the Bell Labs of the 21st century. Bell Labs. Yes, the research arm of the one-time Bell telephone monopoly. One of the overlooked benefits of that monopoly was it paid the bills for a peerless research enterprise, and the 20th century was invented there. The transistor, Brohier said, the laser, cellular radio, solar cells, radio astronomy, CCDs and LEDs, Big Bang radiation. Nodding, Goldstein took over. 8 Nobel laureates, 30,000 patents, an average of 1 a day, and all of it the product of enlightened capitalism. In its heyday, Bell Labs was the equal and more of any university department, any government research center, any quarterly profit and loss corporate lab anywhere in the world. Well, I'm afraid we've fallen a bit short of that, said Horton. Not at all, Goldstein said as the door chime sounded. I could not be more pleased. Jeffrey, I long ago reached the point where I'd made more than enough money to satisfy a lifetime's ordinary desires, at which point there arises the burdensome question of what to do with the excess. Ostentatious consumption has no appeal for me. Neither does charity in the usual sense. There is no Goldstein Foundation bestowing grants on Jewish MBAs or slow-footed midfielders or the children of city bureaucrats. I do not give to save the whales or feed the birds or sponsor music in the park. At that point, the chauffeur reappeared and Goldstein fell silent while she placed the blue and white picnic cooler she was carrying in the middle of the stone table. She started to remove the lid, but Goldstein raised a hand and stopped her. We can see to it, he said. Thank you. I expect that'll be all for tonight. Yes, sir, I'm going to stay in, though. So if you change your mind, we'll look in Carl's game room first, he said, smiling tolerantly. Where was I? Music in the park. Music in the park. Jeffrey, money whispers to you like a whore, telling you what it can do for you if you'll only open your wallet. And if you have no shame, you can be seduced into almost anything. Standing and moving to where the cooler sat, he began moving brown paper bags from inside it, and then white boxes from the brown paper bags. Carl, we're going to need plates and some spoons. I'll get them. Cracking the lid of one container, Goldstein took a deep breath of the escaping steam. What do you do with a few extra billion? Collect art, like Hearst? Collect women, like Hughes? Most of the examples at hand are embarrassments. When Bill Gates paid for the Ares mission to Mars, that was a stunt. Nothing more than ego gratification. He was seduced into trying to buy immortality for himself and his company logo by hijacking an historic event. I promised myself I would never be that weak, and then fell under the spell of an even more fickle temptress. Jeffrey, I have nearly 100,000 people working for me in 18 states and 7 countries. I invested in them to make money. I invested in you to make a difference. Now you've given me that chance. Goldstein sat on the edge of the table closest to Horton and leaned forward as though about to reveal a secret. Guns and bombs have been the vector of power for 400 years. Some call the gun a great equalizer, and yet more often guns seem to me the great unequalizers. In the last century, guns and bombs herded Jews and gays and gypsies into Buchenwald, struck down 3 American presidents, killed 50 million people in war and nearly that many in peace, exterminated dozens of tribes and hundreds of species. The people with the most guns, the biggest bombs, and the greatest readiness to pull the trigger, these were the beneficiaries of the ingenuity of Nobel and Colt and Winchester. Of course, that was business too, Brohier said, reappearing. He carried a tray of plates and utensils to the table and reclaimed his chair. Yes, and as shameful a business as it was a necessary one. You cannot reason with a rifle bullet fired from across the battlefield. You cannot negotiate with an artillery shell lobbed from over the horizon. You cannot compromise with a nuclear warhead screaming in from half a world away. The only answer to the gun, the only defense against the gun, has been more guns. You've given us another answer, Jeffrey. You've given us a way to tear this terrible inhuman tool out of our clenched primate fists. If we take the power of the gun away from the world, what will come forward to take its place? Horton asked. Perhaps chaos, said Goldstein. Perhaps peace. Imagine two armies, now facing each other across the battlefield, empty-handed. Will 21st century men throw themselves on bayonets for God and country? Imagine the terrorist, the would-be assassin, unable to deliver his cowardly anonymous blow from a distance. Now, imagine Tel Aviv, Belfast, Sarajevo, Los Angeles as oases of peace. With one of your devices radiating from a tower at the heart of each city, imagine how many plowshares we could build if we stopped buying swords. Fallen short, you say. Oh, no, Jeffrey, not at all. The trigger is a gift of incalculable value. I pledge to my children and yours that I will see its promise fulfilled. I pledge my fortune and my life to that. Then Goldstein straightened up and threw his head back, eyes closed. So many words, tumbling over each other to get out, he said. I warned you, didn't I? Come, let's eat. That will silence me for a while, at least. But the food hardly slowed the torrent of words, for Goldstein was not the only one who had had no audience for thoughts burning to be spoken. And over crystal fish, Hunan lamb, and black tea, they began to hammer together the outline of a revolution. Okay, I'm going to jump a little farther forward. And engage the question, who do you tell? Who's the next one you tell? At this point in the story, there are five people who know about the trigger. And the argument has been about who should be the sixth. Where do you go from there? Aaron Goldstein has arranged a meeting with a friend of his from the Washington establishment. This is not what some of the others had in mind. So, a light breeze was blowing across Arlington National Cemetery, taking the edge off what was warming up to be a quintessential, oppressively humid Washington summer day. Even so, Willman was perspiring freely by the time he walked from the Sheridan Gate to the gentle hill where the remains of Dayton Charles Arthur Dyke rested in the shade of a 100-year-old maple tree. The tree interrupted a line of white marble headstones, and its spreading roots had pushed Dayton's headstone a few degrees askew. Over the last year, the sole visitor to Dayton's grave had been a private of the 3rd U.S. Infantry, who paused there briefly to place a small American flag in front of the headstone in preparation for Memorial Day. Through this annual tradition, the old guard remembered and honored his service and sacrifice. But the chances were that no one else did. Dayton had died half a world away and more than half a century ago, a drafty corporal who fell during a bitter Korean winter and an even more bitter defeat. Dying at 21, he had left no descendants. The closest of his living cousins was three generations and five states removed. But Dayton was not alone in fading from sight. As Korea's youngest veterans passed from the stage, Dayton's war had crossed the line from memory to history. Now distilled down to a Cold War skirmish which boasted no patriotic songs or triumphant images, it had lost all its pain and passion. Even the most basic facts had left the collective consciousness. Rare was the civilian who knew more about Korea than could be gleaned from the classic television comedy set there. Ridgway and MacArthur, Pusan, Incheon, and the Yalu, their emotional resonance was gone. But it was the same for all of Dayton's neighbors in the old graves on the hill in Section 20. Even those who fought in a good war could not count on visitors to break the settled solitude. We give you this little piece of the earth, Grover Willman thought as he neared the two men waiting for him at the tree. Allow you this little claim in a realm you no longer inhabit. To what end? An exercise in propaganda, sanitizing the truth. The honored dead in their final rest, with no hint of what they did, what they endured to earn that dubious honor. No blood, no torn and broken bodies, not a weapon anywhere in sight. Just row after row of sterile white stones lying by their silence. I hate this place more than any other I know. Carl Brohier frowned. Is that him? That's him. He doesn't look happy. I don't expect he is. Maybe we should have just picked him up in your car and gone for a ride around the Beltway, said Brohier. That would have been private enough, wouldn't it? More private than this. One cheap audio telescope and... I know how he feels about Arlington, said Goldstein. This is a better way. He moved towards Willman with a smile and a hand offered in greeting. Grover, thank you for meeting us. You said it was urgent that we talk, Willman said, looking past Goldstein. I know you. Where do I know you from? That's not important, said Goldstein. Come, let's sit, Carl. The blanket. They settled in the shade on a red and black stadium warmer, looking for all the world like three brothers lingering a time at a family gravesite. What do you have for me, Aaron? Would it brighten your day any if I could offer you the prospect that there would never be another grave dug in this cemetery except to bury an old man like me? I don't quite know what you mean, said Wilman, frowning. The casualty rate in the U.S. Armed Forces is the lowest it's ever been. Even when we put forces in the field, the machines do most of the fighting. Combat deaths are so rare, they make all the news. That half of the battle's nearly won, Aaron. Casualties are no longer acceptable. He nodded in the direction of the Pentagon, hidden from them by distant trees. Now, if only we could get them to care as much about the Hutus or the Brazilians. That's expecting too much, said Brohir. Why? Men have willingly killed other men's children for 10,000 years. Makes more room on the planet for their own. Oh, Christ, don't invoke Darwin to me, Wilman said in disgust. I've heard a lot of sociological drivel about the other, and I'm telling you, the only thing it means is sometimes we can't hear the wives and mothers crying. Explain what you mean. Happily. Tell me what you remember about Desert Storm.
Desert Storm, gracious, that was...
You know, there are great gaps in my awareness of current events over the last 60 years. I think I was having my crisis at Bell Labs. I was in an Abrams M1A1, said Wilman. Go on, whatever you remember. Well, you'd think I'd remember more, since every TV everywhere I went seemed to be tuned to CNN for what seemed like a month straight. Let's see, we had the stealth fighters, the smart bombs, and Schwarzkopf. They had Saddam Hussein's Scud missiles and an air force that ran away to Iran. It wasn't much of a contest, as I recall. No, it wasn't. And the Iraqis set the oil fields on fire, didn't they, when they left Saudi Arabia? Kuwait. Right, Kuwait. So how did I do? You remember what most people remember, said Wilman offhandedly. It was a good war. Our cause was just. We won handily, and almost everybody came home. He gestured at the seemingly endless field of headstones surrounding them on every side. Not very many here who died that winter. And that's too bad. What? Because the good war is a lie. Desert Storm was a horrible little war. And the most horrible thing about it was how little of the horror made it back to Frog Leg, Mississippi. We went to war for big oil and the divine right of someone else's king. Not self-defense, not democratic principles. Press treated it like a video game. The people treated it like a television miniseries. Wilman shook his head. In the span of 6 weeks, we killed twice as many Iraqi soldiers and civilians as the U.S. lost in 15 years in Vietnam. But we didn't see the mothers crying, so it didn't mean anything to us. The good war. The good war means that only strangers with funny names are blown to bits. Grover, what if it all could have been avoided, asked Goldstein. What if the Kuwaitis had had a border that no Iraqi tank or Iraqi soldier could have crossed without being disarmed? And what if the Iraqis had known that in advance, Brohir added. Wilman studied their expressions for a long moment before answering, as if trying to gauge their seriousness. The Iraqis had excellent long-range artillery, and a lot of it. A fortified border wouldn't have stopped their army, just altered the tactics. Are you asking me how high the price would have had to be to dissuade Saddam? No, said Goldstein. I'm asking if the war could have proceeded at all, if tank rounds and artillery shells exploded before they reached their targets, if bombs and missiles blew up in midair, if rifle and pistol magazines caught fire when the infantrymen got within 1,000 meters of the border. Frowning, Wilman said slowly, well, there are still such things as arrows and catapults and the phalanx. I don't know that the second century was a great deal more peaceful than the 20th. Still in all, your scenario would certainly have upset a lot of apple carts, Saddam's included, but is it anything more than a fantasy? It's an interesting question, said Goldstein. Let's call it a thought experiment rather than a fantasy and play with it a while longer. Let us suppose there were a technological means by which these results might be achieved. How would you go about introducing it to the world stage if your goal were to put an end to war? In whose hands would you want to place it? I don't want to play the game, said Wilman. Do you have this thing or don't you? We have it, Senator, Brohir said quietly. We call it the trigger effect. We call the device itself the trigger. Theoretical or no, Goldstein said quickly. The prototype is operational. Wilman's whole body shuddered involuntarily. He looked away from the other two men, his gaze unfocused. "My God," he said, "an anti-weapon weapon. The essential tool the UN's Blue Helmet Army has needed for 50 years. And the tool every tyrant will want to disarm his opposition," said Goldstein. "How do we keep it away from the tyrants?" We probably can't. So we'd have to make sure that everyone has it. How difficult is the device to make? How small can it be and still have useful range? How expensive are the components? It's too early to really answer those questions, Brohir admitted. Well, that isn't very useful. But it's the truth. Look, the first lasers were big, power-hungry, finicky, and expensive. After just a few decades of development, $20 bought you one that ran on penlight batteries and fit in a shirt pocket. We don't know how far we can scale up or down from the prototype. We probably won't know that for quite a while. This discovery, was it wholly within Terabyte? You own this thing? Terabyte has never taken a dollar of government money, said Goldstein with stiff pride. Good, said Woman. Not that it would matter in the long run. If they want you, you belong to them, and they'll want you. How's your security been? As tight as we could make it, said Brohir. This conversation is the biggest risk we've taken. I doubt that. And how did you manage to test your prototype on artillery shells and tanks? Brohir and Goldstein exchanged glances. Well, we haven't, actually. A little problem of access. You're going to need to solve that problem, Wilman said. If you don't know the limits and capabilities of your system, you're going to get people killed. The wrong people. That's why we came to you, Grover, said Goldstein. Because we know you share our outlook on how this should be used, and because you know both Washington and the Pentagon from the inside. That's why we'd like you to come aboard. That's why we want your counsel. Wilman frowned. The first I'll give you, if someday these triggers of yours were as cheap as televisions and as common as wristwatches, well, I could let myself dream of living long enough to see that world. But whether I know either Washington or the Pentagon well enough to make that happen, that's highly questionable, which makes any counsel I might offer of dubious value. Why not let us judge that, asked Brohir. We haven't promised to take your advice, after all. That brought a surprised laugh from Wilman. No, you haven't, have you? Well, very well. I think it's your duty to inform the president. Just as Einstein informed Roosevelt about the possibility of the atomic bomb, it was Goldstein's turn to be surprised. But Grover, 5 minutes after we do, the Pentagon will slap a top secret sticker on it. Yes, they will. And you still think we have an obligation to hand it over to them? How does that help move us towards disarmament? It's more likely to move us towards a Pax America. If we're the only country that has the triggers, we'll end up being the only country that has armies. Carl is right, Grover, said Goldstein. I am as patriotic as any man. I love this country, but I sure as hell am not going to give some young Caesar a magic formula for empire building. And you cannot tell me the chairman of the Joint Chiefs is going to share your enthusiasm for making triggers as common as televisions. No, I can't, but hear me out. We need to be clear about the objective. It isn't to keep this discovery away from our government and its armed forces, because you can't. If our intelligence assets don't dig it out, they'll grab it when you start to hand it out. Do you think that will give you more influence, more moral authority, more bargaining power than you'll get going to them first? Probably not, said Brohir, but of course not. You're not trying to keep this from them. You're trying to make sure they don't take it from you. If we make them discover us, we'll validate their every worst suspicion. But if we come to them with this, remind them of all those peacekeeping missions that weren't so peaceful, some of them will realize we can use this to save some of our kids. And then we'll get the trigger tested in ways you never could on your own. At the cost of losing control of it, said Goldstein. This doesn't belong in the hands of the people who are pointing the guns. It belongs in the hands of the people the guns are pointed at. You never had control of it, said Wilman. It's scientific knowledge. It belongs to everyone. How many labs around the world could start building a trigger today if they had access to your information? Goldstein looked to Brohir. I don't know, the scientist said slowly. 30, 40, maybe more. And how many of those labs are capable of making the fundamental discovery on their own next month or next year? Probably a third, maybe half of them. So how much will that top secret sticker really mean? It's meaningless reassurance for our leaders. It represents a year's head start, said Brohir. A year into which we could march into Mexico and unseat Cardenio or annex Western Canada or take back the Panama Canal. But Carl, we could do all or any of those things today. Our military is the best of the best, enough of them to dominate any battlefield on any continent. But we don't do a tenth of what we could do. Why? Because we know we'd make lousy conquerors. We'd pull our punches when it comes time to shoot the dissenters and hunt down the resistance. And because modern industrial democracies don't start wars, they're bad for business. Do you really think there's anyone at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue harboring a secret desire to ride triumphantly into Vancouver? I don't want to take the chance. There have been adventurers in the White House in the past. There may be again, sooner than we imagine. There are no risk-free alternatives, Carl, and I'll say this. If I had to pick any existing government of any major power to trust with this for a year or two or five, I'd pick this one. They may not do the right thing by our lights, but I'll take the chance that they won't do the wrong thing. I wish I shared your confidence. I know these people, Carl. So does Aaron. Ask him his opinion of the president. And there's something else to consider. If this discovery of yours reaches Baghdad and Havana and Phnom Penh and Kiev before it reaches our people, someone's sure to use it against us while we're trying to catch up. You have to picture the trigger in the hands of the people who are trying to hurt you, not just the people you're trying to help. I believe Grover is correct, Carl, Goldstein said gently. We need to talk to the president. Bro here shook his head violently. This is not what I pictured at all. Well, I would not have you thinking me a trusting innocent, Carl. Aaron, if you decide to talk to the president, I would be happy to make the arrangements. But before that day, there are two steps I would urge on you. One is to apply for a patent on the trigger technology. There's a secure application procedure. That'll complicate any attempt to edge you out. The Pentagon versus the patent office. What's the line on that fight? What's the other thing? Wilmot ignored Brohier, addressing himself to Goldstein. The other is to give Mind Over Madness a copy of the plans, all the technical information, and a list of those labs, too. Why? Because you can't unring a rung bell. Because they can swear you to secrecy on threat of imprisonment and death for treason, but they can't get back the words that have already left your lips. Because I might be wrong about all this and have to do something to try to undo the damage. You might want to make plans of your own along those lines, just in case. Wouldn't that be treason, too? Perhaps. Woman turned his head and looked out across the headstones. What happened to our breeze? The air is suddenly heavy. I'm dreading the walk back. He rose to his feet, and the others followed suit. Dr. Brohier, a pleasure meeting you. You see, I remembered after all. My congratulations on your new discovery. Who knows, perhaps your next Nobel will be the Peace Prize. Aaron, come see me in a few days. Tell me what the two of you have decided. Dr. Brohier is not ready to decide today. Is that unreasonable? The price of being wrong is very high, said Brohier. Yes, it is. And I can't promise you that I'm right. I know that we're prepared to be the policemen of the world, but are we prepared to walk that beat with an empty holster? That I don't know. When you change the rules, you change the game. Gentlemen. He nodded at them and started back down the hill. Watching him go, Brohier ran his fingers back through his hair and sighed. Aaron, did he just take over? Goldstein paused in the business of folding the blanket. No, but he would if we asked, or we lost our way or our will. So he's going to be standing behind us with a spear exhorting us to glory? Something like that. And this was part of your plan? He is a tiger, said Goldstein, glancing in the direction Woman had gone. We need his strength. He brushed perspiration from his forehead with the back of his hand. And I need a drink. Let's go. They picked their way in silence through several rows of headstones before turning and following the aisle between two rows. In 10 sweltering minutes, they were back at the car, parked inconspicuously in the congestion near Arlington House. On the way to the West Gate, a signpost for Roosevelt Drive caught Goldstein's eye. Does anyone know? Would Einstein have done what he did if Hitler hadn't already invaded Poland, he asked. Yes, said Brohier, holding a handful of ice to his neck. He actually wrote his letter to Roosevelt about the bomb the month before. It took Sachs 3 months to deliver it. Oh, never mind then. No, that was exactly the right question, Brohier said. I was reading out of my later years on the way here, wondering what Einstein had thought about that letter later, after the Manhattan Project, after Hiroshima. And I learned something I hadn't known and wouldn't have guessed. Einstein and the Hungarian conspiracy, Szilard, Teller, Wigner, they wanted to stop Hitler, yes. But they were also idealists, pacifists. They thought the discovery they were bringing to Roosevelt was going to put an end to all war, not just that war. No, yes, they believed that the atomic bomb would bring about world government, and through it, world peace. Brohier glanced sideways at his companion and smiled ruefully. Something to think about, eh? Goldstein's only answer was a gloomy countenance and the sound of gin cascading over crackling ice. Okay. There's a lot more book, but I think I'm going to take that as a stopping point because I'd like a chance to talk with you in the time that's left. Yeah. Yes, I have. I have. Outside of science fiction, I read a lot of Alastair MacLean and Alan Drury, and always been interested in that. And yes, West Wing is one of my favorite shows. Pardon? No. Aaron Golds, or I'm sorry, Sorkin, yeah. He doesn't need any help from me. That man I have the most respect for. Terrific writing, just terrific. Although even he couldn't save The Rock, but that's not his fault. He didn't have much to work with. I forgot to put on my MSU National Championship button. Just sucking up to the audience, that's all. Yes? As in, why aren't we there yet? Oh, yeah, lots of people wanted to go and have their face ripped off by... I don't know. There's been a resurgence in stories about Mars in written science fiction, too. Kim Stanley Robinson's series and Greg Bear's Moving Mars and several others. I think it's gotten sexy again, partly because it seems like it maybe is the only place we can actually reach. I don't know about you, but I'm really disappointed. There were supposed to be orbiting space stations that looked like, you know, carousel wheels by now. This is not the future I was promised. You know, I grew up reading Boy's Life, you know, and looking at those images of the future where everybody would have the big car that had the little car in the back of it and personal helicopters and all of the other wonders of what a friend of mine calls the Adam Land view of the future. You know, and it's really taking an awfully long time to get here as far as I'm concerned. I feel like I'm going to see even less of it now than I thought I was going to see. So that's part of why I write science fiction, is I'm trying to play in the futures I may not be around for. Have some fun around the next curve, you know, that blind curve where you can't see what's coming next. That's part of the appeal for me. Yeah. You would not be alone. You would not be alone in that.
But I can't say that they're the best of them.
Thank you so much.
They were the most compelling that scared me.
Thank you so much.
Now for the question. I know Sir Arthur Clarke does exhaustive research before he writes anything. I read the list of citations in 3001.
Yeah. Very much. I actually can't start writing until it's real enough to me that I can pretend I'm not making it up. I mean, for me, the experience of writing is of witnessing. So it's got to have that degree of reality so that I'm, so that the place, the people, the event,